Support for Soundwaves from the Underground is brought to you by 24tix.com, the most convenient way to buy tickets to your favorite local concerts. Save time, save money, rock out. 24tix.com, your ticket to the experience.
So you could actually do that research yourself.
I'll have to do that.
You could put your crack team of multi-talented and multitasking researchers on that one.
We got that. Gavin, she's putting us to work.
I'm Dan Nalen, and this is the Soundwaves from the Underground podcast, the official podcast of Slug Magazine in Salt Lake City, Utah. Slug, an acronym for Salt Lake Underground, is one of the oldest independent publications in the United States, distributing free monthly issues about music, art, action sports, and subculture all over the Salt Lake Valley and beyond. This episode, we're delving into just one little part of town, and we're going to talk about it in various forms. We're talking about the River District, which many of us call the West Side. It's Rose Park, it's Poplar Grove, a lot of different areas. We have Kyle LaMalfa from the Salt Lake City Council who represents the area. We have a statistician from the University of Utah, Pamela Perlick, doing an interview here in the studio. And then Charlotte Fife Jepperson, who created her own community newspaper to represent what was really happening on the West Side. That paper is called The West View, and we'll talk to her later on in the episode. Well, here we are down in the subterranean Soundwaves from the Underground studio space, and we have Kyle LaMalfa from the Salt Lake City Council and a representative of what we're calling the River District for this episode. Thank you so much for coming down into this frosty confines, Kyle.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
Really appreciate it, and we're going to delve into a few different things here, but why don't we just start with a little of your personal background. You've been on the Salt Lake City Council for about a year now, a little more than a year since you actually took office after getting elected in November 2011. What kind of things were you into before that, and where might people know you from?
I've been living on the West Side for about 10 years, and back in 2004, I was working kind of a dead-end job and really looking for a promotion. So I enrolled in this class called the West Side Leadership Institute, and in that class, I thought, oh man, I'm going to take this leadership class, then I'm going to be a certified leader.
I'll have paperwork to prove it.
I'll have paperwork to prove it, and my job will have to give me a promotion.
Nice.
And it turned out to be a community leadership class, and instead of learning how to manage people in a job, I learned how to bring people together to rally around a cause, and it turns out it was something I could really believe in, and that first year in 2004, I organized a community yard sale. And at the end of the community yard sale, the people who participated rallied around and said, man, we got to keep this going. Right. We need a farmer's market. And so I grew that into a little farmer's market. And that farmer's market is called People's Market.
Yep.
It's every Sunday during the summertime.
Yeah, still going strong.
Going strong.
Many years later now.
I mean. Yeah, actually, it's almost 8 or 9 years now.
Yeah, so we got up to post-market. You continued on boards and things.
I continued on boards and commissions at the neighborhood level, at the county level, at the city level. Governor Herbert appointed me to chair the Council on Urban Agriculture for the whole entire state of Utah.
Oh, wow.
Based on my experience at People's Market.
Yeah.
And at that point, people around me said, you know, you ought to run for office. And so that's what I did. I ran for city council against an incumbent who'd been there a long time, and I went door to door. I knocked on 4,000 doors.
All over the River District.
All over West Side, and I won. Before, when I was in this phase of boards and commissions and serving in different capacities around the community, before I ran for office, I decided, I'm going to go to this. We need more businesses on the West Side. We need more businesses in the neighborhood. And so I went to this neighborhood development conference put on by Mayor Ralph Becker. It was at Westminster College. And at the end of that conference, they said, we're going to have this grant program where business nodes like 9th and 9th business node or 15th right. and 15th business nodes can apply for this grant to advertise their business node. And I thought, man, we need one of those. Yeah. West Side needs one of those. But as I looked around the West Side, nothing really gelled in terms of what was a magnet for right. for business activity. But what we did have a lot of were nonprofits. Nonprofits like the Sorenson Unity Center, nonprofits mm-hmm. like University Neighborhood Partners, so a couple of schools. We have a Boys and Girls Club.
Right.
All kinds of nonprofits around the community, churches that serve our community members. I called a meeting I called everybody I knew who ran a nonprofit. All the executive directors are on the West Side. And I said, we need to do one of these business shows, but we're not going to do it like they did. We're going to put all of our nonprofits together and create a nonprofit node. Right. Yeah. But the thing is, they were all spread up and down the West Side.
Sure.
So what seemed to gel among the group, and I'm not going to take credit for the name, but what seemed to gel among the group was, we are all connected to this river. And what we need is a business node grant to support our efforts around this river that binds us together. And the notion of the River District emerged from that dialogue.
Nice.
So we went to Salt Lake City and said, we got a business district. We got the River District. And it's not one little corner like Ninth and Ninth. Right. It's the whole river. And they said, well, what businesses you got? And, well, we're all nonprofits, but we're all retail. We serve people the same way a retail business does. And they said, well, no.
That's a bit of a stretch too far there.
That's
right?
Too far, yeah. So that was kind of a sad day. But the notion of the River District carried on. Students from the University of Utah decided they wanted to study that name.
Mm.
So they went around to different schools, different communities, asked them about the River District name, and eventually raised their own money to put out these banners, like street banners, and to buy the hardware to affix the banners to all the light poles up and down Glendale and Poplar Grove. And they put out the name. There it is. It's out there. River District. Welcome to it. And that's sort of, that's the history of the name River District.
Yeah.
Some community members have said, you know what? I like that name. I like that name because it's trying to replace the name of the community that I identify with. I identify with Poplar Grove.
Right.
Some people identify with Glendale, Fair Parks, Rose Park, all distinct communities with names and histories that deserve to be preserved and recognized. The River District isn't there to displace any of that history or any of those, all the names that we have come to know and love, but rather it's an overlay that binds us together along the river. And that river really has the potential to transform what has been known as a rough and tumble part of the city into a nature corridor that's fun for recreation, that connects our parks, connects our community centers, connects even businesses up and down the West Side.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. I'm sure people out there have all kinds of different sort of images in their head if they're not from these neighborhoods. And is that one of the big issues to deal with when you're talking about a big project like this, or what's essentially kind of not a renaming or a rebranding, I guess, of the thing, but is kind of getting people over these preconceived notions and kind of exposing them to what's really there versus what's in their mind or what they think is there?
I mean, I won't deny it. 30 years ago, there were some problems, but those are long since gone. And what remains is a unique community of affordable houses, close to recreation, great parks, and even really close to downtown.
Yeah.
I mean, you can get a house 5 minutes from downtown for half the price as what you would pay at the equivalent east address.
Yeah, and it's really fast, a really quick trip to get down there. I mean, I've known plenty of people who have bought houses over there. And
yeah, unbelievable. Yeah. Unbelievable. The last piece of the river trail that needs to be finished is this, basically between the Great Salt Lake and Utah Lake, there's basically a trail that goes all the way through, except between Second South and North Temple. And there's a power plant and a substation and some Union Pacific train tracks that are in the way. But this year, the county, all the people of the county voted on this trails bond, and the money is now there to finish the trail. So when we complete the trail, we will truly have a river walk that goes all the way through the city and also connects basically the Great Salt Lake too.
Yeah, I mean, all the way through the south end of the valley.
All the way through the south end.
And all these communities will now have this thing, an artery, I guess, of sorts that connects them to South Jordan even, or West Jordan.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Is that, has that been sort of the main, obviously those the kind of projects are a long time coming and has been being worked on even before you were in office on the city council, but.
Sure. I mean, the entire river corridor, I think, was a project identified in the 60s.
Right. And it's we're finally going to see it. We're finally gonna vision. See it. I mean, and that's how it works, folks. That's government, right? And that's land use issues and everything you have to go through to get those kind of projects done. It's amazing. What are some other sort of things you have, a vision for, or maybe things that are already in motion in the River District? You know, maybe other aspects of life over there that are being worked on right now.
One of the concepts around River District, which had been promoted by an organization called NeighborWorks, is that we would use the River District as a general theme for the Broad River Corridor, and then at each major crossing of the river with a street, there would be a unique identifier, a sub-brand or something like that.
Right. Area.
The 9th and 9th West area is up and coming. There's a Smith's there. There's some other... A hair salon and
small business,
Panaderia, Flores is there as a little bakery. They've sort of identified as the River District Gardens business node because it's right next to the Peace Gardens too.
Right, a great park. Yeah.
Well, so that spot, 9th and 9th West, is an incredible nexus of a trail, a river, a business node, a park, and a neighborhood. As unlike any other place in the whole city. And the potential there to really do something remarkable with terms of all those things that we like to participate in as residents of Salt Lake City, they're all going to be in one place, and it's right in the heart of my district.
Yeah, that's exciting. I mean, that is. Those are just everything you described are like the quality of life things that make people love living here in their neighborhood or they're with their park in their neighborhood or whatever it might be. So
right. That's if we could just get a streetcar over there, that would really be a business.
Yeah, there you go. Hey, it's never impossible, right? You know, you've been in office as a city council member now for a year, and I'm just kind of curious of, you know, what did you have in mind that has maybe evolved since you've been in? I mean, does it function as you kind of thought it would be? Obviously, you'd been involved in a lot of ways and probably went in with your eyes pretty wide open knowing, but how has it been a little maybe different than what you expected, or what's been more challenging or even maybe easier to do that you would have thought not?
I, of course, made the same mistake I think every elected official makes when they go into office, thinking that they will go in and they will be able to direct money to the projects that they think need it the most. And at city council, that's not really what you do.
Right.
That's the mayor's job, actually.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Right.
What you do in city council is you govern and you lay out policies that are broad-based, that are applicable to all of the neighborhoods in the whole city, and you do it in a way that where your mind is focused and trained on the Salt Lake City that you want to see in 10 years, long since you've left office.
Right.
And the projects are really slow to emerge, but the people who imagined the Olympics started way before.
Right.
They didn't get to enjoy the Olympics,
right.
But they were able to imagine the Olympics and the difference it would make in the city. The same with this North Temple. North Temple now has a tracks line, and I get to be showered in the credit for a tracks line opening while I was in office, when really it's the previous 10 years that deserves credit for that.
Right.
So I'm, you know, systematically laying out some visionary ideas for the city in terms of the way that we enhance our business nodes, in terms of the way that we take action and engage the public.
Mm.
Honestly, I don't expect to see the fruits of my labor until I'm long since
gone.
You have to
be the big picture guy, right? Do you feel, just personally, you know, obviously you've been wired up with your community and working with these people in different roles even before you're on the city council, but does being the representative in an entity like a city council, I mean, does it make you feel all the more connected to your community, or is it like, I have to take every phone call from every constituent, and maybe you would be anyway, but, you know, you're going to get my pothole in front of my house call, plus bigger picture things like this train is messing with my business, when is it going to be done, all that. I mean, just personally, does it make you feel all the more, I guess, involved than you ever were before, or is there any way to compare?
Oh, yeah, very much so. It's very much more involved than I ever was before, and the week after I was elected, I set forward and resigned from every board and commission I was on, knowing that I would embrace this new role with everything I had. I gave my personal cell phone number out to every door I canvassed, all 4,000 doors. And still, on all my business cards, my personal cell phone number, And yeah, I get about a call a day. And some of them are, this pothole, where's the snow plows?
Yeah.
And some of them are like, my neighbor has a barky dog. Right. Some of them you can do something about, and some of them you can't. I do have a liaison who I share a liaison with other council members who will follow up on those calls.
Okay.
But I certainly don't have a problem taking the first call, and certainly don't have a problem being available through Facebook, through email, through phone, through Twitter even. I've really relished the continued connection with my community, and I try to make it out to the churches and the schools as much as I can. It is a part-time gig.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, there are 4 council seats that are up for election this year. And I only know of 1 council member who is, of those 4, who's going to run again. That would be Stan Penfold.
Oh, wow.
He was going to try to keep his seat on the avenues.
Right. So he's relatively new to the council as well, right?
This is his second term.
Okay.
Yeah, second term.
Okay.
So Soren Simonson's been around for 11 years. He's going to rotate off. He's in Sugar House.
Yep.
Jill Remington Love, she's in Liberty Wells area. And Carlton Christensen in Rose Park, they're all going to step aside.
Whoa.
And let new people come out. So I strongly encourage people to consider it. Women especially, with losing Jill, we're losing the only woman on the council.
Right.
And people of diverse backgrounds, it'll just be all white dudes. Unless
yeah,
some people
step up. We
need to
shake that up a little, right? That's right.
It pays $25,000 a year, which isn't enough for any of us to quit our day jobs.
Right, yeah.
We all kind of have to do double duty. And it's all consuming between the community council meetings and meeting with constituents and meeting with people who have businesses that have a vested interest in the area. It takes up a lot of time. Me and my girlfriend, all of our dates now are to like charity galas, ribbon cuttings. Like, that's it.
You can come to the meeting tonight.
Right.
We'll count that. I appreciate that you're making the call for people to step up. What are some other ways that you'd recommend for somebody who's hasn't ever been engaged with a government entity or even on like a neighborhood council type level? I mean, are there some ways that you can just point some of our listeners to where they might want to, even if it is as easy as going to Facebook and staying involved and staying informed that way? Or?
The city website has a list of all of the neighborhood community councils, which are a good middle ground between grassroots organizing and government. They're not an arm of the city. They're all independent.
Right.
But they are quasi-government because we send people. I go to them. We send our representatives to them. So community councils are a good place to start. But besides community councils, there are all kinds of grassroots groups that aren't necessarily organized with a 501c3. There are groups around bullying. There's groups of small farmers markets.
Right.
Group, you know, yard sales and stuff. Even just on your street, meeting your neighbors, there's lots of opportunities to get involved in Salt Lake City, get involved in the neighborhood, and to care about our future. I may not be in government for a very long time, but I will definitely be involved in my neighborhood for the rest of my days.
Right, and yeah. That's where we all are going to be, right? Like, you want to be involved at least with your street at the very least, right? If you want to have a say in how things are going,
right.
Let alone a bigger picture. And it takes visionary people to think about that 10-year window out, you know, and not necessarily need that immediate reward, I guess.
Right, right.
Well, it's an interesting time. I really appreciate you coming in, Kyle. Thanks so much. I think that does us great. And hopefully we'll talk to you again and catch up and maybe see what happens around election time.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody, you can get more info. I believe it's slcgov.com in terms of Salt Lake City's government. You can go there and track down all kinds of different groups. Kyle Amalfa, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
We have a brand new band on the scene here in our first music slot of the episode. This is Color Animal, and some of you will know Andrew Shaw, the leader of the band, from his time in The Platt. This is his new, more sort of straightforward garage rock 4-piece that he's got going on. We're going to play the title track from the band's debut EP, Vision Lies. This is Color Animal. That was a track from Color Animal's debut EP called Vision Lies. For more information on the band, go to facebook.com/coloranimal. Pamela Perlick is a senior research economist for the Bureau of Economic and Business Research at the University of Utah's David Eccles School of Business. She does some professing as well. She's a teacher and adjunct in the Department of City and Metropolitan Planning at the school, and she also does some amazing breakdowns of statistics about the people of Salt Lake City, the demographics of those people, and she talks with the media quite a bit about our changing city all the time. Slug's junior editor, Alexander Ortega, sat down with Pamela in the Soundwave studio to talk about our shifting demographics of the west side of Salt Lake City and the changing culture in the city in general.
Which minority groups are most present in the River District, and what's the state of any white population in this district?
The largest of the minority groups in the River District is the Hispanic population, but mm-hmm. we have many international ethnic enclaves. I mentioned the Somalis for
right.
one. But you remember that a lot of the other ethnic enclaves, say Bosnians or Serbians, that example,
yeah.
they're answering white, so they don't show up in the data so much. There are, I am not intimately familiar with these neighborhoods. You should speak to some people who live in these neighborhoods to get a real feel. But the new populations that have come in have been very diverse.
Yeah.
And not always welcome, but sometimes very welcome. And there are many people who live in these neighborhoods, pick these neighborhoods specifically because of the rich cultural heritage that they're finding in these neighborhoods. So I don't know that you could say what is the state of the white population, because there again, there's so many people in the white population. And
the ethnicities become conflated.
Yes, and there are many, many subpopulations of white people. You can't put us all in one basket either.
right.
But it's on a neighborhood by neighborhood basis. This is where that real interesting, well, that's where life occurs, right?
Right.
It's in neighborhoods, not in numbers.
Yeah.
I would defer to some of the residents and some of the community folks to give you a real on the ground look at that question.
Right. That reminds me of something my grandmother mentioned from last Halloween. She lives in Glendale. I also used to live across the street from her, and she commented on the diversity of the trick-or-treaters
mm-hmm.
that came by her house, mentioned specifically the diversity. And so...
Oh, Glendale's very diverse.
Yes.
Very diverse.
With tracks about to go along North Temple and businesses sprouting up on said street, do you think that this type of impetus will spur local commerce throughout the West Side, or that it might only homogenize in Rose Park, or conversely southward into Poplar Grove and Glendale?
Certainly, when they put that new line in, I know they paid a lot of attention. There was a lot of community involvement in how exactly that was going to be a gateway to the River District.
Yeah.
And I know that they were careful. Some things they were very careful to leave accessible. Anytime you put a big transportation corridor in, that has the potential to kind of put a wall up and keep some people in and some people out. But I know they've tried to make it so that it would be a factor of growth, a factor of opportunity, a factor of accessibility.
Yeah.
A lot of that has to do with, exactly how all those areas are zoned, what kinds of businesses go in. It's going to bring new business to around some of the hubs. And the question is, how is it going to impact all of those neighborhoods? That's a really good question. But generally speaking, what happens when you put in light rail lines is that you do get development around the hubs. And, you do get people locating and putting, for example, some multifamily housing in, or putting in some mixed-use stuff or whatever, just like it's going on in the tracks line north and south.
Right.
When that'll occur, how it'll occur, I don't know, because economic development is in a lot of ways very organic. It's
uh-huh.
some developer or some group of people saying, you know what? I'm ready to invest a large amount of my resource to see if I can make a venture go right here and a belief in it. But independent of that, the new populations that have moved in and immigrant populations just in general tend to be very entrepreneurial.
Uh-huh.
This is partly because of that in the receiving communities, they're not always welcome or they don't necessarily feel welcome. And so they do, they're very, very resourceful. And this is a kind of a hotbed of small businesses and the informal sector and all kinds of creative types of enterprises.
Yeah.
And then once the community sort of establish and stabilize, then when you begin to see economic development maybe to serve that population or possibly employing people doing things that the native population's not been doing or not good at or whatever.
Right.
So, and again, I don't have the intimate understanding of the different communities, but there are people who do and who could give you kind of an on-the-ground look at, you know, some of the longer-term businesses over there, how they're doing, and who some of the new businesses are. And I know the city has had kind of an incubator effort more on the east side than the west side. That's what this paper is about how to how the city might consider re-engineering some of its business incubator plans that have worked pretty well on the east side, sort of re-engineer them so that they fit the River District.
In light of Salt Lake and Utah's population growth chiefly through immigration and an increase of minorities, and with areas of west of I-15 now being included in what's being called the River District, will the west side continue to foster other cultures with the same upswing, or might it be subject to gentrification?
That's an interesting question. That is a very interesting question. You know, I'd hate to see that happen because, again, new populations, young populations need affordable housing, need rental housing. And we see a concentration of that on the west side of Salt Lake City. And then you look at South Salt Lake City and you see West Valley City. And then, you know, there's not a lot of opportunities for ethnic enclaves in a lot of the suburbs. So I would hope that there would always be places where we would have affordable housing for new populations. You know, it's always interesting to see which neighborhoods do gentrify and why they gentrify. And we, like you said, we live in an area of the country, the Intermountain West, that is a net in-migration area. Remember who moves. Young people move.
Right.
And remember who have babies. Young people have babies.
Mm-hmm.
So this reinforces, you know, a population dynamic, young and with kids. And that reinforces what is already a kind of a Utah population characteristic, which is young and with kids.
Yeah.
You know, that would be a very interesting question for people who are in those neighborhoods. Do they see signs of gentrification? But for as long as it's an affordable housing area with rental units available and with established ethnic enclaves, remember, people move long distances, not as an individual choice, but as a community choice. As long as those communities and enclaves are there, then that'll, you know, that area will continue to be much more culturally diverse and have many ethnic communities.
Right.
If the price of housing were to go up there, which would be a shame to not have affordable housing, then of course people would have to look for other options. So I see it as continuing to be an ethnic, rich ethnic diversity and ethnic enclaves. I mean, we also have international communities that are connected to the university and that are connected to other dynamics besides you know, that's not the only only immigrant enclave. And we see immigrants through, you know, up the I-15 corridor in places in Midvale and in Salt Lake City, in South Salt Lake City. But it's really about access to affordable housing, transportation, employment, and education for their kids.
Right.
So any of those things you change will change where people live. They're all, in the end, population location policies.
Thank you.
On June 25th of last year, KSL quotes you to say, if we get that next generation educated and healthy, they will do better than they were than they otherwise would have. Do you feel that the current education system or systems in Salt Lake City can facilitate prosperity for up-and-coming generations, especially those of immigrant slash minority descent?
Oh, I think there's very broad recognition that we're not getting that job done, that our education system broadly here in the state of Utah is really underfunded. The tax cuts that have occurred in the Huntsman administration and later reduced the amount of funding to education in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Meanwhile, the student population is growing. Well, layer on top of that, that we have many, many different languages of students, mm-hmm. that we have increasing inequality. Remember, a lot of these changes that are occurring in the population are direct effect of Utah and Salt Lake City becoming a global city. As we become connected to the outside world, then we have integrated labor markets, meaning people come and go, integrated products markets, and integrated financial markets, all, you know, so that means working class here is competing with, you know, the story, China yeah. and India and all the rest. This increasing inequality that's occurred means that you've got a growing population of people of very little economic means. Meanwhile, average income's going up. Okay, so this inequity then is driving two very different experiences in the educational system. You've also got kids, you know, who are coming to school hungry in those kinds of situations, right, where their parents have lower income. Then you've got all the students whose parents don't speak English. You remember that about half of the recent immigrants to the state, the men don't have high school degrees from their countries of origin.
Right.
The old model, you know, rewind back to 1960 during the baby boom, where mom's home, mom spends a lot of time teaching kids how to read, but even before they go to school. I mean, even in the large class sizes, those kids are getting an education that fits them because they're all, you know, mostly white kids, English speakers, you know, it's a very homogenous culture, so yeah. you can, like, use the same books for everybody, and it's cool.
Uh-huh.
And now that's not the case, and we've got, you know, I mentioned 119 languages, so you've got that increasing socioeconomic inequality, many more people, lower income people, and people with coming from backgrounds of not much education, so the parents can't really help their kids in school the way parents who are educated can help their kids. And just a curriculum and an educational system that is geared to have high expectations of white kids and not always high expectation of the little brown kids and the immigrant kids. I mean, it's a real phenomenon. Some educators just don't have the same expectations of those kids that look different than the kids who've been coming to this school all these years.
Right.
So, you know, you add all of that up and you look at the crushed funding that we have for education here in Utah. It approaches a crisis. It can't continue. Dropout rates for Hispanics, only about 40% of them are even getting through high school. You know, this is not acceptable.
Right.
It really is not acceptable. And so we are not serving our ethnic minority populations well.
As an institution.
As society.
Uh-huh.
I mean, as adults, it's my moral responsibility to make sure that those kids, no matter whether they're my kids or not, is really irrelevant, that the
right.
next generation gets the education and healthcare that it needs to be successful. That's, you know, they just take the education that we give them. So there's currently some really serious efforts. Prosperity 2020 is one of them that's occurring. It's occurring among business elites in the state, and it's occurring also at the level of a governor's office. But it's also occurring in the school districts themselves. If you have the opportunity to talk to Superintendent Withers of the Salt Lake City School District, mm-hmm. and talked with him about the community learning centers that they're putting in, we're putting one in Glendale.
Right.
So they recognize that we need to seriously re-engineer what we're doing, way amp up the resources that we're applying in these neighbors, in these distressed economy is, to help these kids be successful. The current educational system is failing many of these kids.
Yeah.
High dropout rates, and you know the sort of vicious cycle that perpetuates. There are a lot of efforts going on. It's going to take re-engineering of how we
practice education, but mm-hmm. it also is going to take a lot more resources. While I'm standing on the soapbox here, we really need to pay our teachers a lot better than we are, so we can attract really talented young people back into the classrooms. Real wages for teachers have gone down significantly.
To read more of Pamela Perlick's studies and some of her research, check out the University of Utah's City and Metropolitan Planning Department at plan.utah.edu. This is your weekly daily calendar of some awesome events coming up in the week between February 19th and February 25th of 2013. There's some real goodies in here, so listen up. As always, you'll want to go to slugmag.com and check out the calendar listings. They are updated all the time with lots of great shows and other events. On February 19th, big show at the Depot. New Orleans Galactic, a fine, funky soul band, headlining. They have Lyrics Born on the bill as well, so that'll be a great show. Over at the Kilby Court, you have Ruby Suns, who played the Twilight Concert Series a couple years ago. Some of that sort of twee, folky pop off of Sub Pop Records. And the State Room has the amazing violinist and singer Carrie Rodriguez, a real roots queen. She's from Austin, Texas, and does some really great singer-songwriter stuff of her own. On the 20th of February, the infamous String Dusters, a fine modern bluegrass band. They're headlining up at Park City Live in Park City, so if you like to get that twangy thing on with lots of banjos and fiddles, Infamous String Dusters are for you. They can throw down a mean show. On the 21st of February, the Banff Film Festival takes over Kingsbury Hall. It also is on the 22nd as well. They have a lot of great outdoor films based out of Banff up in Canada. Really cool stuff. 22nd of February, the one and only Stephen Patrick Morrissey headlining at Kingsbury Hall. His tour has been sort of bedeviled by canceled dates and health issues, so we're going to cross our fingers this one's going to happen. It was delayed from a November time, but Morrissey, obviously a huge pioneering force in alternative rock music, and you have no doubt that that one will sell out. The same night, James McMurtry, a cantankerous rootsy guy, he's playing at the State Room. And on the 23rd of February, local big loud rock show featuring Thunderfist, Spork, and Charlie Don't Surf, all at Burt's Tiki Lounge. That will be a blast. That is your weekly daily calendar. As always, hit up slugmag.com. You can enter your own listings for free or for a mere $5 a month. Add yourself some quality content to attract more people to your thing. Even $50 a year, you can do even more. Videos, you name it. Once again, slugmag.com. Check it out every day. Night Sweats, you know you've seen them. They are a blast of an electronic rock band that's played for, 6 years or so, I'm hearing from Gavin, our producer extraordinaire. Hard for me to believe that this is their debut EP, but so it is. It is called Red. The rotating cast of lineup has currently hunkered down into Dick Diamond, Mike Drone, David Payne, Stephen Chai, and Chris Controller. The debut EP released just last month. Here is a song called Bodywork from Night Sweats. For more information on the band, check them out at facebook.com/nightsweats. Westview Media is a nonprofit news organization that was set up several years ago to cover issues and stories on the West Side that weren't really getting the attention that they were felt they were deserved by the founder, Charlotte Faith Jefferson. She sat down with Slug writer Ben Trentelman to talk about the publication and to talk about what's happening on the West Side.
What can you tell me about the Westview? How long has it been around in the community?
This version of the Westview has been around for about a year and a half. It was started up, the original Westview started up about 10, 11 years ago. And that existed. It was a black and white paper, smaller in scope. We didn't have as much circulation. That ran for 4 years. Then we took a six-year break. It was largely my husband and I, but as well as community members. So we took a break longer than we thought, a six-year hiatus, and now we've revived it.
Did you see an immediate need that made you want to revive it, or what drove you to make that choice?
Yes, just so many stories to be told, so much dynamic growth and action on mm-hmm. the West Side, and so many people were saying, we miss that paper. Mm-hmm. We miss having a vehicle of communication, you know, and a lot of nonprofit organizations were saying, how do we get the word out to people? You know, we really miss that paper. When are you going to start that up again?
As far as that goes, I mean, we have the Salt Lake Tribune. Mm-hmm. They have their local section every Thursday that does some highlights in different areas. But do you feel like this has been an underserved area or an area that hasn't been given its due respect and how it's represented publicly?
Yes, definitely. Probably underrepresented and misrepresented in the media traditionally, although I have seen a huge improvement. Mm-hmm. You know, I think instead of just seeing a story on a shooting or a body that they found, you know, on the Jordan River, there are a lot more stories that give credit and do justice to the incredible diversity and all the incredible things that are going on the West Side. You know, in the past, they highlighted crime. Mm-hmm. And I think it made many people who live in Salt Lake City not want to set foot, you know, west of the train track. And because they thought it was this crime-ridden ghetto.
It was literally the other side of the tracks.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And they were afraid. And I'm not kidding. I've been a piano teacher for over 25 years.
Okay.
And had a piano studio in the avenues. When I moved my piano studio to the West Side where I live, people were afraid mm-hmm. to come to the West Side. They were really afraid. And I couldn't understand that. Mm-hmm. I've lived there my whole life, you know?
Yeah, that's what I, as a West Side transplant myself, still encounter a lot of that myself. And people are still mm-hmm. like, how does that work out for you? How is it over there? What's it like? Like, it's going into some crazy militant zone in Africa or something like that, where it's like, it's really pretty good. And I live by Liberty Park, and I lived in the avenues, and I have lived everywhere else downtown. And I've had more bikes stolen and cars broken into anywhere else than I have right where I'm at right mm-hmm. now, you know? And so a lot of misconceptions. On that note, there are several assumptions and misconceptions about the West Side that I think kind of focus around the fact that there is such a diverse ethnic culture in the area. I feel, you know, without going out on a limb here, that sometimes that's what people fear about the community, is that there are more Latinos, there are more Polynesians, there are more people in all kinds of different ethnicities. How have you observed the multi-ethnic growth? Is it meshing? Do you feel like it's a solid cultural movement, or we've got all these things going in all these different directions? What's your perception?
Well, having grown up on the West Side and having lived there my entire life, you know, mm-hmm. 41 years, I see a lot more diversity now, and it's cool. I mean, we've always had diversity, but there is a lot more diversity from people from all over the world, mm-hmm. and some of that is, you know, just a lot of immigrants and refugees and then people from different economic backgrounds who are moving to the West Side mm-hmm. and seeing what a cool place it is, and how growing up around people who have international views and different views of the world is such an incredible experience. We chose to raise our family. I have three boys, and I wouldn't want to live anywhere else mm-hmm. because of the diversity.
River District has been kind of this new, and to me, I've perceived it as something that's been growing, has been gaining some momentum as kind of a new entity in our many districts, and is kind of getting up there as far as, you know, the avenues or Sugar House and these other districts that are getting to be kind of cool and interesting to other people. What do you see there?
First of all, the term River District is a rather new term. Yeah. It's come about through some planning and architecture students at the University of Utah who have this West Side Studio. It's a partnership with University Neighborhood Partners. Anyway, the University of Utah is trying to create pathways to higher education, and they're partnering with a lot of different college departments from the University of Utah. Anyway, these students have started going out into the community and trying to help create a sense of identity, you know, a new, exciting sense of identity so that this negative perception does not persist. So I think they kind of came up with this river district because the river is the thread that ties all of the West Side communities together. There are six different community council areas. Mm-hmm. They all share the Jordan River, which is, so this new river district, I think it's exciting. There's a lot of talk about development, and there's a new West Side master plan that is trying to develop business nodes, mm-hmm. you know, to create walkable, livable communities, more walkable and livable. Yeah. I mean, the West Side has always had that, but this is presenting it to the public. You know, look what we have here in this river district. First of all, the Jordan River Parkway is one of the most beautiful assets in the entire city that has long been neglected.
Underutilized, for sure, and had its own reputation as being like a body dumping ground for the city. And for the longest time before I had ventured over this way, that's what you heard about, as though they dragged another body out of the Jordan River, I guess. But getting over there, it's this huge asset. It's a tremendous asset to the community, and it's great that they have all of that. Along with the work that you've been doing with the Westview, have you been doing a little bit of work with some of the youth in the area as well with the Westview? Tell me a little bit about that.
Oh, well, we try to get community contributors. We have a community newsroom, but we partnered with the West High, their journalism program, and we've had some West High students contribute articles. We've also featured a piece on the Jordan River itself that talked about creative writing students who wrote poetry and photography students from West High who they learned about the ecosystem and about the Jordan River and explored it through photography and creative writing. And so we featured some of their work. We also had a conversation cafe. We're trying to bring teens of different backgrounds together in meaningful conversation. And that was really cool. We had like a diverse representation of religions, of races and cultures and backgrounds, and they were just, I was so amazed with the youth, you know.
In addition to the youth, you said you have a community desk there, how do other people from any of these neighborhoods get involved with Westview?
Well, we have a community newsroom that meets once a month. It's on the third Monday of every month, and we meet at the Sorenson Unity Center from 6 to 8 p.m.
Okay.
And so anybody who wants to write about, you know, write a story or report on an issue that they think is significant to their community can come, and we can help them through the process of writing a story. So they get some journalism training in a supportive environment, you know, to learn about journalism.
Excellent. Fantastic. Have you brought in any other collaborators for that as well, like the Salt Lake Community College Writing Center, anything like that?
We are working on getting them involved.
Great.
We've brought in some community journalism experts in the field.
We spoke a little bit about the business landscape in the area. I mentioned Ninth South and Ninth West specifically as kind of being branded as the other Ninth and Ninth, or the West Side Ninth and Ninth. From what you see, is there a potential for a mix of businesses and characters similar to the Ninth and Ninth East area, or what do you think that people in this community are looking for as far as that goes?
Well, I think it's somewhat different because we have the environmental aspect. It ties right into the Jordan River.
Yes.
But the International Peace Gardens are right there, which is a gem in the city. Another underutilized, underappreciated area and garden, but it definitely reflects a lot more cultural diversity and will have to tie into the environment. So although there's some room for some commercial nodes there, light commercial development, it's going to be about the river and about tying into the international flavor of the West Side.
see the West Side as becoming more integrated into the downtown area or growing more independently as we see West Side festivals like the Jordan River Fest and the People's Market becoming more prevalent?
You know, we've always had this physical boundary of I-15 and the railroad tracks separating us, as well as our, you know, income diversity. So, I mean, I do see that we're as, like, there's the Greenery District that's being developed and art space. And with tracks, the tracks line and also the 9 line, which is a trail that replaced the 9th South Rail Line.
Yes.
You know, there more connections are being made. And as people become aware of the assets of this area, I think even more, you know, that bridge will develop, continue to develop.
Yeah, I feel like it's one of those things, like we had said before, where people are still like, yeah, what's it like? How is it over there? Where people will still say something like, yeah, I hear it's really been improving over there. I hear that, you know, it's been getting better. I hear a lot of younger people are moving over there. But it still is one of those things where they still have to kind of have that aside. But it still is, you know, the West Side, and it still is this, you know. But it's one of those things, like I said, I'm from Ogden. And what we'd say there is, you know, we actually let people believe all the crazy stuff about us so that they stay the hell away from us.
Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of one of those things where it's like, well, this is our community and it's growing in our own way. So let's embrace that and roll with it and turn it into our own thing.
We are pretty proud of our local identity. We like to be called West Side, even though it kind of divides, but it's something that we have owned, you know, take ownership and pride in that. We will continue to develop and have Rose Park. I mean, there are like little festivals and farmers markets popping up and festivals that we use to celebrate our uniqueness. But, you know, I think it's time that we let the city see our assets so that we're not underrepresented in government and civically. There are costs of being isolated.
Yeah.
So
it's true. And I'd love to see more businesses being attracted to the area. Mestizo is an amazing coffee shop, but they can't serve the whole West Side, you know?
No. Yeah.
So what hurdles do you see needing to be overcome on the West Side to continue with the current momentum that we're kind of rolling with right now?
Well, we need some business development and that reflects the diversity of the people here and that can make it a more walkable, livable neighborhood. So you can go to a bookstore, you can go to a sandwich shop. You know, we have some of the most incredible Mexican food anywhere, you know, but I mean, and I'm not complaining about that, but you know, maybe we need some Bosnian restaurants or, you know, we also have like African food and different ethnic foods. That's, I think more of that would be welcome and a more diverse range of businesses.
Definitely. My wife and I were beside ourselves for the minute that the Mad Greek opened up on North Temple again for like a year that they were there again, and now they're gone again. But now it's another place, Archie's Burgers, which is delicious.
Oh,
you
should
try that place if you haven't.
I have. It's good.
The main focus of the River District appears to be the Jordan River Parkway. What steps do you see being taken to give more life to the river? Are the River District residents buying into that? Are they embracing all the changes being taken around that river that they all live around?
Well, I think that some of the residents are that utilize the parkway and love to see, you know, wildlife in their little, right in their backyard. But there are some, and legitimately, that are concerned about safety. And so, you know, when an area is underutilized, there's more chance for it to, you know, crime to happen. So I think if people got out and used it more, that would be a good thing. But there are different nodes along the Jordan River that are being developed, like the Bend in the River. It's an outdoor urban classroom. We have a community project. They're trying to create some wildlife habitat and native plant restoration along where the 9 line used to be.
Okay.
So, I mean, there are incredible amount of species of birds that migrate. It's a migratory corridor right there on the Jordan River.
Yes.
Of course, environmentalists and people who care about the natural world love the Jordan River. Also, health-wise,
yes.
I mean, I see people out there, families, biking, walking, rollerblading, taking their dogs out. That's happening more and more.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great. You know, it's healthy for everybody involved. It involves, I mean, it builds community because you meet your neighbors and, you know, it's good for their health. So.
For more information on the Westview Media, visit them online at westviewmedia.org. As always, thank you for listening to the Sound Waves from the Underground podcast. And for all things Slug Magazine, be sure to visit slugmag.com. Next week, we have Jeffrey Stedman, our regular visitor from Yelp, and he's going to be in the studio to talk about Thai food. And we want to know what your favorite spots are around town. It's obviously a burgeoning Thai food scene here. They've gotten to almost outpace sushi joints in town. So send us an email, soundwaves@slugmag.com, or call and leave us a message on our automated voicemail line at 858-233-9324. That line is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Give us a good message about some awesome Thai food. We just might play it on the air. This podcast was created by Slug Magazine and produced by Gavin Sheehan. The associate producers are Esther Moronio, Ricky Vigil, Alexander Ortega, and myself, Dan Nalen. The executive producer is Angela H. Brown. The theme song, performed by Birthquake and recorded by Jesse Ellis. The main logo and art design is by T. Doan, and the technical design is by Kate Colgan. Be sure to fire us up again next week when Soundwaves from the Underground will take on Cab Rails. We'll talk to Yelp, and Joey Arisa, performance artist, will be in the studio.